participate in this event. I hope, well, I'm sure I will learn a lot of things which I don't know. I'm certainly not an expert in quantum information theory, although I believe I know a little about quantum mechanics. And the subject of my talk about random graphs, I'm not really sure how relevant it is for quantum information theory, although I realize that there is another talk with the title of random graph in the, with the words random graph in the title, so maybe there are some chances. But random graphs certainly have connections to random matrices. And actually, I hope you can read this. So my original motivation for being interested in random graphs is comes from quantum physics, actually from a certain way of approaching the problem of trying to understand quantum gravity by discretizing manifolds. So quantum gravity can be viewed as a theory of random manifolds. And if you discretize the manifolds, a natural way to do so is to do it in terms of random triangulations, which are to be viewed as special cases of random graphs. So this is not really what I'm going to focus on in this talk here, but if you are interested in knowing connections between random matrices, for example, and this particular approach to quantum gravity, there is a monograph by myself and Jan Ambjørn and Torbjørn Jonsson where you can find some of the details. And there are also many good review papers on this around. So I will actually mainly focus on connections between random graphs and percolation theory. So I'll not really discuss percolation theory in detail, but try to explain. I use most of my time to explain what random graphs have to do with percolation theory and how certain aspects of random graphs can be used to understand large scale structures of percolation clusters in particular. So there are also a lot of other topics where random graphs appear, such as random media and also as a general way of looking at structure of networks, which I will not really say very much about here. So I will start by discussing some very elementary concepts, which you probably all know, of graphs, just a fixed notation. So this will not take very much time. So a graph consists of a vertex set and an edge set, where the edges are viewed as pairs of vertices. And we will always consider simple graphs. That means that there is only one edge connecting a pair of vertices, or at most one edge. And all graphs will be locally finite. That means that that the degree of vertices is finite, although I will actually consider mostly infinite graphs later on. So a path in a graph is simply a sequence of edges such that two subsequent edges have one vertex in common, and they are not allowed to, a path is not allowed to intersect itself. Whereas a path which intersects itself is called a walk. I will call that a walk. Now, the graph distance between two vertices is simply the number of links in the shortest path, or in the at the minimal number of links in a path connecting the two vertices. And we say that G is connected with any pair can be connected by a path. I will mainly be interested in so-called planar graphs, and that means that these are graphs which can be drawn in the plane, in the sense that you can map the vertices into points in the plane, and you can map the edges into arcs which which connect the corresponding vertices in such a way that these arcs are not intersecting each other, except at possible endpoints where they coincide, can coincide. So this is actually important for many purposes that you stick to planar graphs. So in order to define the notion of Hausdorff dimension of a graph, we define the notion of a ball. So a ball around a vertex in the graph is simply the subgraph which is generated by or spanned by the vertices at graph distance less than or equal to r. So r is the radius of the ball. And by numerical value of the ball, I mean the number of edges in the ball and not the number of vertices. So in my notation, the Hausdorff dimension of an infinite graph, which is also connected, is simply the volume growth exponent of the ball as a function of the radius of the ball. So more precisely, as the limit, provided it exists. I mean, this limit does not exist always, but if it exists, this is what defines the Hausdorff dimension. It is not always called, I mean, the Hausdorff dimension is maybe not a good name because it's also used in other contexts, but it has become quite normal to call this the Hausdorff dimension. Now, there is another notion of dimension of a graph, which is the so-called spectral dimension. And in order to define that, we have to introduce the so-called simple random walk on a graph. So a walk on a graph, as I said before, is just a sequence of vertices, so that two subsequent, a sequence of links, such that two subsequent links have one vertex in common. But these are allowed to intersect each other. And then we introduce, for each such walk, we introduce a probability, P of omega, which is simply the product of the inverse powers of the degrees of the vertices. So the degree of a vertex is simply the number of neighbors of a given vertex. So you take the product over all the vertices except the last one in the walk. This is called the probability of the walk with respect to a simple random walk. So this means more precisely that this P actually defines the probability distribution by construction on the set of walks of a fixed length or given length, but arbitrary length. So in that sense, these numbers define what we mean by the simple random walk. Now, for a connected infinite graph, you can define the return probability at a given vertex simply by taking the sum over all walks which start and end at a given vertex and with a given length t. So this function depends on t, which you can consider as the discretized time. And the behavior of this probability for a fixed vertex b0 as a function of time is what defines the spectral dimension. So in other words, if this probability decays as t to minus an exponent, then this exponent is by definition the spectral dimension divided by 2.
Factor 1/2 or 2?
It is just to make it fit with the case where you have, for example, the integer hypercubic lattice. If you take the two-dimensional lattice here, for example, actually this is valid for all graphs, and that doesn't have to be planar for this definition here. So if you take the integer lattice, this has actually both Hausdorff dimension and spectral dimension. So it should be a matter of that's the reason.
Are there any balance between those two dimensions?
There are inequalities which you can provide under certain assumptions. In fact, under rather general assumptions, you can prove something like this, that ds is larger than or equal to 2 times the Hausdorff dimension divided by 1 plus. Such an inequality is valid quite general. I'm not going to use it here. And also, I think this one from here is also proved quite general. But otherwise, they are unrelated. I mean, you can easily provide examples where they have different values. And I'm going to actually show you some examples. But these notions here are actually two rather fundamental notions if you want to analyze the structure of large graphs. So although I'm going to talk about many infinite graphs, the aim is actually to understand large graphs. So the difference between two notions, and the Hausdorff dimension all doesn't really depend on interconnectivity of the graph, it only depends on the number and the size of the ball, whereas the spectral dimension, which is defined in terms of a random walk, actually involves quite strongly how the connections are in the graph. So I'm actually going to consider not fixed graphs necessarily, but ensembles of graphs. So this just means that we have a space of graphs on which there is some probability measure, which I call mu here. And then you can define the Hausdorff dimension and the spectral dimension of these ensembles by just replacing the size of the balls by their average values, and also these return probabilities just by taking average values with respect to this measure. So this you might call this the annealed values of these Hausdorff dimensions. Yes.
Why is it natural to take the average inside and not?
Yeah, I mean, you can do both, right? So this, one could call these dimensions the annealed Hausdorff dimensions, right? But you are actually just as often interested in actually almost sure statements, for example, that in this ensemble you have that the Hausdorff dimension is almost sure in some fixed value.
Right, but it shouldn't be the same.
I don't know any examples of where they are not the same, but I mean, in principle, they don't have to be the same. But in the examples that I know, they actually turn out the same. And an additional thing is that you use actually quite different techniques for proving, I mean,
sure,
average value or for the other one, right? So for some examples, one may be easier than the other, and vice versa, for other examples.
No, but why is it natural to average? I mean, these dimensions tell you something about what happens when the graph grows.
Yes.
If you take the average before you let the graph grow,
you could.
What exactly tells you is not clear to me.
No, that's absolutely right. But for the examples that you're interested in, for example, in percolation, you actually expect that these, if you look at large, for example, percolation clusters, that they have some characteristic property, which is
right,
and that they don't vary too much. Right? So actually, in that case, you can actually prove almost sure statements about the Hausdorff dimension. It doesn't mean that you can have sub-ensembles which have different Hausdorff dimensions, but if you have chosen a measure.
So if you take the collation in ZD, it will be the same annealed and quenched?
Yeah. I mean, in the ensembles, I know that they tend to be the same.
Just simple percolation in ZD.
Sorry?
Supercritical percolation in ZD, it will be the same.
Yeah, I mean, there you have almost sure statements, actually.
Yeah, but is it the same constant? That's my question.
Yeah, they're the same.
Yes. Okay.
By quenched, you mean the average is outside the log?
Yes.
Yeah.
Or no average, at
no,
all.
Average.
It's the same.
Just almost surely constant.
And are you going to talk later about why the name spectral? I mean, is this?
Well, I'm not going to talk about that, but you know, the random walk on a graph is intimately connected with the heat kernel operator, right? So you can actually, at least on in some cases, relate this exponent here to the density of the spectral density close to zero.
Okay.
Of the operator. So this is the motivation.
Why is the two there?
The two?
Yeah, this drives me nuts.
You mean this one here?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, this is just to make it fit with the case where you have a hypercubic lattice, for example.
Okay, thanks.
So the measures that I'm going to consider are actually will normally be given as limits of measures on finite graphs. So we normally consider a finite set of finite graphs, and then you have some probability distribution of that, for example, the uniform distribution, and then you prove the existence of the limiting measure. I will discuss this in a particular example, if I have time at least later on. And then you can discuss the limit in terms of just by making the set of graphs into a topological space. One standard way of doing this is to use as a distance and to define the set of graphs as a metric space by saying that the distance between two graphs is small if they have large balls which coincide. So here I'm normally considering graphs as being rooted graphs. So you have some graph, some root in your graph, and then you're looking at balls around this root. And if you can have a large ball in two graphs which coincides, then you say that the distance is small, right? So for example, this is one possibility, that the inverse of the largest ball distance, which are common as subgraphs, measures the distance between the balls. This is a very nice metric on the space of graphs, turns it into a nice metric space, and you can then discuss convergence of measures on the space here as weak convergence. For example, take integrals of bounded continuous functions. If they converge, then you say the measures. If you have a sequence of measures, mu n will converge in the weak sense. Actually, in this metric here, this means exactly the same thing as if you take a finite graph containing this root here, then the measures of the set of graphs whose balls of a given radius coincide with this finite graph here, if they converge, then this is actually equivalent to weak convergence. And this is just one property of this metric. So this is a very nice way of expressing convergence. It's also a nice way of actually proving convergence in these cases. So I will discuss this in weak convergence you probably know. I mean, this is discussed in many probability books, and in this particular instance here, I discussed it in a paper some years ago. But this is actually not really my original idea here. I mean, these types of convergence have also been used, for example, by Schramm and Angle to discuss convergence of triangulations, which is a particular case of random graphs here. And also this notion of distance, at least implicitly, have been used by probabilists earlier. So as an example, let me discuss the so-called incipient infinite percolation cluster for the case of bound percolation, just as an example of a particular case of random graphs. So percolation is simply defined on a, if you have a given an infinite connected graph, say it's a rooted graph, then you define bound percolation as in terms just by defining a measure rho as an infinite product measure over all the edges, and each edge may be occupied or empty with probability p or 1 minus p. this is bound percolation with occupation probability p on this graph g, simply defined by this measure here. Now, for general graphs, you cannot say very much about this, but for particular cases, there is quite a bit known. So, for example, if you consider the case of the hypercubic lattice in dimension at least 2, we have the following, that there is a critical probability, P critical, above which the clusters have a positive probability of being infinite. So the percolation cluster, I mean, the configurations defining on which this measure is defined is simply the set of can be viewed as the set of clusters of occupied links. And this defines a measure on the set, on the connected cluster which contains this root R, which I have called here CR. So CR is simply the connected cluster generated by the largest connected cluster of occupied links which contain the root. And the probability of this cluster is positive about this critical probability, and otherwise it is zero. So it's known that there is this critical probability. Now, one question is, what happens exactly at this critical probability? I mean, are clusters finite, or are they infinite at this critical probability? And in large dimensions, and in fact also in B equals 2, it is known that the clusters are actually finite with probability 1 at the critical probability. So there are no infinite clusters there. Now, this D larger than or equal to 19 is probably just due to a technical question here. The techniques which are used actually require this. But it's expected to be the case in all dimensions that this holds true. On the other hand, if you look at below the critical probability and you compute the average size of the percolation cluster, then it turns out that this size actually, that this probability for P less than behaves exponentially as a function. I mean, if you compute the probability of a given size of the percolation cluster, it can be shown that this decays exponentially as a function of the size of the percolation cluster with an exponent alpha of P, which actually then goes to the zero when P goes to the critical probability. So this actually shows that the average size of it is finite below the critical probability, but it will actually diverge when P approaches this critical probability with some exponent whose value one actually is interested in computing. Now, I shall not do that, but the important point to notice is that clusters of large size actually become more and more important when you approach the critical probability from below. Okay? And what one is interested in understanding how they actually get large. I mean, what is the characteristics of large clusters close to the critical probability? And then one applies a standard trick of probability theory that you actually extract the information extract the information about these large clusters, how they look like, simply by taking and looking at the measure obtained by conditioning on large clusters and then taking the limit. So we know that the clusters are finite, but you condition on them and then you take the limit. And actually, you then prove that the limit exists as a measure now on infinite clusters. This will be a probability distribution on infinite clusters. Okay. Now, again, in larger than 19 dimensions, you can prove the existence of this. You can also do it in two dimensions, no dimensions. You can do it. So in two dimensions, it was done quite a long time ago by Kesten, and then later, I mean, just 6 years ago or so, for D, this D large actually also means this was proven. The existence of this limiting measure was proven. So this is what is called the incipient infinite cluster of percolation. Now, it's a famous conjecture by Alexander and Orbach from the beginning of the 80s. That the spectral dimension of this random, and this is a probability measure on on random on clusters of infinite size, that the spectral dimension of V should be 4 over 3 in all dimensions was the original conjecture. But nowadays, it's not believed to be true, actually, in low dimensions. But it has actually been proven to hold in large dimensions. And again, this means in dimensions where we know that these exist, be larger than or equal to 19. But it is expected to be true also for lower dimensions, but also, but not in all dimensions. So I will actually try to convince you or show you a result about the value of this half dimension in the particular case on this spectrum, this value of the spectral dimension for the particular case of percolation on a Cayley tree, which is actually what I'm going to discuss next. Because in this case, the clusters are actually also trees. So we're in that case considering random trees and not general graphs. Yeah.
Understanding of this number 4 over 3.
Well, it's not so. It's not intuitive. No. But, I mean, you can actually get it if you believe that there is an equality here, which may be hard to believe. But then the point is, it's easy to, for percolation on the hypercubic cubic lattice, it's not so easy to calculate the Hausdorff dimension. But for this example I'm going to discuss in a moment, it's easy to calculate the Hausdorff dimension of random trees, which is almost always true. In that case, I mean, for E, E H equals 2, you actually get the 4 of 3. But generally speaking, it's only a lower. It's not only a lower bound. But I mean, one can, of course, still, I mean, Alexander and Olberg, of course, have some sort of qualitative arguments. So it's possible to give them, but it's not very intuitive. So the case of a Cayley tree, so a Cayley tree is simply a tree, all of whose vertices have the same order. So here I'm considering also a special rooted Cayley trees. So the root is assumed for my purposes to have order 1. So in this case, percolation is rather simple to discuss. So if you want to write down the probability that a given configuration of occupied ones, that the cluster of course would be a tree, so the probability that the cluster is equal to a particular tree T here is simply given by this formula here, because you can just write down explicitly what the probability is in order to get this particular tree here. So p to power, so you have a product over all vertices in the tree, and then if you just look at which of the forward links at this particular site are occupied, and you have to pick out a certain number of those, so which is equal to the degree of the vertex minus 1, and then you have p to that power, and then all the other vertices are not occupied, so you have 1 minus p to the rest. So this is the probability that you get, and this p here is just the probability that the root is the root link is occupied. So if you condition on the set of those trees where the root link is occupied, because otherwise it's not interesting, then you get a weight or a probability of trees, which is given by this formula here. So it's a product of certain weights, which depend only on the degree of each tree. Of the degree of the vertex in the tree. So such a weight is such a form of the weight of the certain tree is usually called a Goldman-Watson type distribution, because Goldman and Watson were some of the first to discuss this case from the point of view of Giuliani's logical trees back in the late 1800s, I think. It was a very long time ago. So the probability, so pk, which is called the, this is the probability that the vertex has order k plus 1, This is given in this particular case by this binomial expression here. And they, of course, add on to 1 in this case. So in this case, it's a polynomial. It's a polynomial function of P, of this probability P. Okay. So in the following, actually, I will discuss more general Z's, I mean, which are not necessarily given by this expression, but always by an expression of the form of Galton-Watson. That means in this case. Now, the advantage of discussing this particular case is because you can compute essentially everything. If not explicitly, you can actually you can set up equations which determine the critical behavior, the behavior of this as a function of P. So one introduces normally the so-called partition function, which is simply equal to the sum over the probabilities over T's with a given size, N, it's called Vn. So I want to condition on T's of a given size, N. So then we introduce the generating functions for these numbers, Zn, and also for the probabilities Pk. This is not so readable. Then there is a fundamental relation which actually determines the partition function as a function of this variable t. This one here. This is very well known by probabilists. I mean, the way do you actually calculate it is just this diagrammatic equation here. So this is the generating function for the z's. This is the partition function. And you can decompose the partition function simply by looking at what is the order of the vertex which is closest to the root link. I don't know where this is so difficult to see. Yeah, maybe it's okay. Well. Okay, so I just wanted to mention this equation, which is just, I mean, you can just read it off, I mean, in terms of the way that the probabilities are defined. So this is, so you get that the partition function is equal to this variable's time the generating function of the probabilities pk taken at zt. So this is an equation which actually determines the behavior of z of t. So just to indicate what is going on. I mean, here we have the curve y is equal to z, and here I have plotted the curves y, the graphs of the curves f. So f, the generating function, depends on p, as on the occupation probability p, and they look like these. So if p is equal to 0, it's just a constant, right? So you have to solve this equation here. So that means that in order to determine z of t, you have to draw the line here which has slope 1 over t and look at the intersection with the corresponding curve of the graph of ft. So for example, here I have the blue curve here corresponds to t equals 1. It intersects ft here. So that means that this is z of 1. Okay? Now you see that for small p, there is this trivial solution that c of 1 is just equal to 1. Now when you increase p, then the curves, I mean, the curves will look like this. I mean, I have not drawn a representative. I have drawn a representative for p larger than p critical here, but p critical is actually determined as the value for which this curve, f, the graph of f of p, is tangent to this blue line here. Because for smaller piece, this curve, which will intersect only at the point C0 of 1 is equal to 1. And that actually means that the total probability of finite trees is 1, right? Whereas if P is bigger than P critical, then the curve will intersect here, and the largest value of Z that can be obtained is actually up to the point where, so you take the tangent and the straight line through 0 with the smallest slope, which is tangent to this curve here. So this, the maximal value of Z that can be obtained, for example, for this value of P here, is actually at this value here. Right? So it's only when P approaches P critical here that the value of Z of P actually gets all the way up to 1. So this determines the critical value of the probability. And that can, of course, be computed just by equating the derivative or f of fp with 1 at t equals 1. And if you solve that equation, then you find out that that for the case of a perturbation on a Cayley tree, the critical probability is simply equal to 1 over n minus 1. This is 1. And this actually means that the average order of a vertex is actually equal to 2. So the forward order is actually equal to 1. So this then you have this condition on the probabilities, that the average value of offspring in the tree, of descendants of a given point, is actually equal to 1 at each level. So that is the critical probability. And now, I mean, once you have, once you have determined that, you can actually discuss conditioning these measures on finite trees of a given size. And you can actually determine the limiting probability. So I'm going to use the last 5 minutes to explain how this looks like. We can discuss this case actually completely generally. So we have given these offspring probabilities pk, which add up to 1, and we assume they are critical in the sense that the average value of offspring is equal to 1. And then we have then the only assumption that we make, that you have to make, is that that these probabilities are generic, in the sense that if you look at the generating function, you should only require that it has a convergence radius which is bigger than 1, strictly bigger than 1. It is obviously bigger than or equal to 1, but it could in principle be equal to 1. But this case we exclude. So with that assumption, you define the conditional measure on trees which have size, a given fixed size, big N, in this way here. And then you can actually, from the equation I had before, for the generating function, deduce that it has a square root singularity at 1, at t is equal to 1. It is because of this, it has a quadratic minimum because of this genericity assumption. And from that, you can actually deduce that generically, Zn behaves as n to minus 3 over 2. This is very characteristic of the case of trees, that entropy of trees is given, has this power behavior. And then there is the following theorem, which is general for this class of distributions, that the limiting probability measure when n goes to infinity, defined on trees, infinite trees, is given as follows. First of all, it is concentrated on trees which have only one spine. And one spine just means that it has one single infinite path from the root to infinity, right? And then the rest of the tree are finite branches which stick out from this unique path to infinity, okay? Now, and the distribution of these branches from this unique infinite path is actually the same as the original distribution, and they are completely independent. So by a branch, I mean a branch which sticks out, I mean which with root vertex 1, right? Okay. So there is a certain number of branches sticking out from each vertex on the spine, and they're all distributed according to the original distribution. And the distribution of the order of a vertex on the spine is given by the derivative distribution. That means that the probability that the spine vertex S has an order which is k plus 1 is always at least 2, right? Is k plus k times dk. These also add up to 1. So this characterizes these meshes completely. It's a little bit surprising, first time you see it, that it's only these trees which are picked out. But it actually is due to the fact that this exponent, 3 over 2, is bigger than 1. Then you can actually prove. Okay? So that is one result. And then the second and final result I want just to mention to you. It's a result that I obtained some years ago through my colleagues, Jorge Johnson and John Dieter from Oxford. That for these trees here, you can prove that the Hausdorff dimension is 2 and that the spectral dimension is 4 over 3, both in the annealed sense and in the quenched sense. So, I mean, more precisely, if you think about the almost sure statement, you can prove, for example, that the size of a ball, the volume of a ball, behaves as R squared up to logarithmic correction. Whereas if you take the average at the quenched point, you can actually prove that the return probability behaves as the correct power with probability with no logarithmic correction. So when you average, these logarithmic corrections disappear. But this is not unusual in these types of problems that you have logarithmic corrections when you want to make almost sure statements. Okay. But I think actually my time is up, so I think I want to stop here. But maybe I should just mention that, I mean, that there are lots of, these are the simplest problems I've discussed here. I mean, so some of the, if I want to get back to the original motivation in terms of, from random triangulations, there are some important problems which are still open. So if you look at, for example, planar triangulations, you can also define a measure of this type here. You can also compute the Hausdorff dimension, which actually turns out to be 4 in that case. But the value of the spectral dimension is not determined yet. It is expected to be 2, but it's not known. So you have a lower bound, for example, which is 8 over 5, but it's not a problem of optimal. So there are many ensembles of interest in relation to these both statistical mechanical problems and also the problems in quantum gravity, for example, which are unsolved and require further. But the relation to quantum probability, I'm not really sure. I hope I will learn something here which necessarily can do some solutions. Thank you.
Yes, so the spectral dimension is something like an eigenvalue of something?
It's not an eigenvalue, but not that I know of, no, but it has something to do with the density of eigenvalues of some operator.
Okay.
I mean, the behavior and exponent, which is related to the density.
Okay, let's thank the speaker again.